Well, hey, this is Dave. I see that everybody's here. Welcome. How was your Thanksgiving?
It was great, Dave. This is Diane. How was yours?
Great. Excellent. I'm back in Houston now, settled in, and going through oyster purloin and shrimp gumbo withdrawal, but everything is great.
Hey, Dave, it's Chris.
Welcome. How are you?
Terrific. How are you doing?
Great. How was your sojourn in New Mexico?
It was outstanding. We had an amazing time. It was really
great. Wonderful. Excellent.
Super. Sounds like your trip to New Orleans was certainly full of experience.
It was great. You know, I've never had that kind of time to just really get immersed in a project of writing before. I kind of bootleg a little bit on the weekend, you know, sunset and that sort of thing. But that was just a totally different experience, and I could get used to that occasionally. So, yeah, it was great. Really productive. I have a full working draft of the book, so things are going very nicely. Yeah, it was just super.
And what is the book about?
This book is about, it's called Engaging the Ineffable. It's things that we deal with on a regular basis, but they're really difficult to talk about, and I look at it from different perspectives and integrate a number of things. From in fact, the last white paper that you had for the mentor group is a representative chapter. It was on desire, remember? So it's 21 chapters of each is a single word of an ineffable that we engage on a daily basis, but sometimes don't exactly know what we're talking about, or I don't at least. You know, things like hope, nostalgia, memory, joy, serendipity, synchronicity, a whole number of things that I really have enjoyed getting to know better and reading different kinds of material from different disciplines and areas and everything from philosophy to science to just kind of put it together. So it's been a fascinating process, really. It's something I wanted to learn more about, so I'm in the process of doing it. So, what about wins and progress notes from everybody else? One at a time.
Lynn here. I'm Lynn Moore. Hi, Dave.
Welcome. Any progress note or anything about?
No, I managed to get my roadmap done.
I know. I look forward to hearing that. I look forward to hearing that, and I want to allot plenty of time for that.
Sorry.
We'll get to that in just a few minutes, so thanks.
Yeah, that's fine. No, I didn't celebrate Thanksgiving here in Canada. We celebrated a month ago. Yeah,
exactly.
Different.
Right, yeah. Kat, what about you?
Hi, I'm working on my roadmap, and I just now walked in the door from having a dental procedure, so I'm still a little bit groggy and a little bit.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
under the,
okay. Well, you're
glad
really off the hook for talking. So, okay.
Yeah.
Anything before we move into Lynn's roadmap that you'd like to talk about or discuss from any of your cases or from reading or anything that is left over from before? Okay.
Lynn?
Go ahead, Chris.
I was just going to say, I'm good.
Oh, okay. All right. I would have to check with Debbie on that to be sure, though.
You might feel otherwise.
But... I know. Okay. Lynn, are you ready to do your roadmap?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, great.
Okay, so my roadmap, basically my money story. I basically summed it up: a need to trade time for money. There's not enough, and I'm not worthy of it. Recognizing my authorship of it, I was raised in a middle class home, and I recall my mom saying, "The months come quickly, stop wasting," and the all time favorite, "Money doesn't grow on trees." So when I wanted something, it usually was a knockoff of a product. It wasn't really the brand name. There never seemed to be enough. When I was 12, I started to trade time for money, babysitting and working at church, at our church banquet hall. And then later on, fast food places when I turned 15. When I started working full time, one of my jobs was working on a word processor for a large insurance company. It was quite advanced for, quite an advanced system for its time. And I just made enough to share rent expense and had a little leftover for groceries and incidentals. When I left that job, after 2.5 years, I started working at the railway, still trading time for money. But here I worked on an old electric typewriter and made almost twice as much as my former job on the word processor. It was it was hard for me to believe I was making so much and had so much freedom at my job, whereas the other one you're pretty much watched all the time. It was like a typing pool, that I thought they had made a mistake on my paycheck. So reflecting back during this time and in prior time in my younger years, I got a sense of not feeling worthy of money, and what I was being paid. So so that was my getting recognizing the authorship.
May I ask you a question? I'm sorry to interrupt. It's a great story. So were you hired there by the government of Canada or by the railway system?
At the time, it was the railway as a company, but it was government-owned when I hired on.
Got it. Okay.
They privatized in 95. They privatized in 95. That's fine.
Ah.
And I got hired on. It was in 84. So my my present money story, so I'm still trading time for money, and it has been part of me ever since my first babysitting job. It comes natural to me. It's what I know to do and what I've always done. I've made attempts to do something different on many occasions in a personal development arena, but have never been able to be convinced that it was the right path to take at the time and leave my full-time job. I'm a fourth-generation railroader, and since railroading is in my bloodline, it so happens to have worked out where I've embraced it as my career choice. It's perhaps not one I feel a need to uphold, but one I seem to be somewhat loyal to, as it's been relatively good to me. I feel a sense of security working there, knowing that I have a regular paycheck coming in and a pension plan once I decide to retire. In assessing my money story and plot and storyline, since what I do at the railway I've been doing for so many years, I'm comfortable. I'm comfortable doing it, though not my ideal job. It meets most of my needs. The need that is less met is fulfillment in what I'm doing, and perhaps one of the reasons I continually look for fulfillment outside my work in personal development courses and training, hoping that one day I will achieve fulfillment in my work. However, I do this with no real commitment to leave my 9-to-5. I look at coaching as my next career, which would have me move away from the employee mentality of the 9-to-5 work week. Personal development courses get expensive and perpetuate my story, there's not enough money. I take courses in pursuit of a better life, and though the courses have been of value, I remain stuck, whereby I haven't the time to hold down two careers. One career with the railway and a second career in parallel as an independent coach. So additional money and fulfillment remain unmet. Though I do some coaching at work when the opportunity arises, it's not at the level I'd like to do it. So what I've decided to change is my money story since I'm doing this. is my current attitude towards my salary job, which I'm grateful for, has given me security and the ability to channel some of my personal time in pursuit of a passion in taking personal development courses, mainly the coaching part of it now. And there is enough money. I need to just better manage it and manage the money coming in and out. I need to apply and put into practice all that I've learned over the years with the money that I spent on personal development. I have time on the train ride into work. There's an hour there in the morning and an hour on the way back to set aside to start focusing on coaching, my coaching business, to move me in the direction of fulfillment in a career that I would love. So some of the some of the changes that I've mapped out is I continually regulate my state of mind to allow me to focus on my day-to-day activities of my 9-to-5. And following this time, I'll focus on creating and implementing a coaching program. I'll remain relaxed and centered during stressful situations. I will check to see if I already have some similar in personal development material before I decide to purchase something new. I will create a coaching program for prospective clients. I will reach out to coaches I know locally and afar to partner with in doing teleseminars. I will be relaxed and centered before I make a purchase. I will manage my money and seek consult if and when I'm uncertain of what I should do next. And now for offering new experiences, I created a mantra for myself that has helped me work since we've started this program, is relaxed and centered. My money mission statement is money flows to me easily and frequently, whereby I'm able to make a positive contribution in the world with my coaching. So some of my goals under my new experience is change the structure of my train ride to better utilize the time to plan and set up a coaching program to market to prospective clients. Plan the night before what I will do on the train the next day. I know many coaches, some of which are, I know one lady I met recently in the area where I live, to do a venture and partner with, which I will call on and be in touch with her to get to know a little bit more of what it is that she does. I'll write up a draft of what I will cover during a coaching program, and I've actually put dates against this. And I will get my website completed, which is, it's been kind of just under construction for a while now. I will, and that's it. I just have a note here to call the coach locally. And for my new identity, programming my new identity, I recognize that growing up, I believed I was unworthy of more, but that was all fabricated in my young, undeveloped mind as it got repeated over and over again. It has influenced me throughout my life. However, I understand now as an adult within my adult mind and thinking that I made that up and that I am worthy. I'm worthy of a lot more and capable of achieving it. Life has allowed me to experience more than perhaps I would have if I was born into wealth. I may not be in a perfect place in my life, but I certainly feel I'm in a better place with more clarity than I was a few months ago. I plan to balance more of my work, family, and personal time to maintain good mental, physical, and spiritual health and continue to grow towards my personal and financial goals. The end.
Wow, thank you very much. That's really impressive. That's a really excellent piece of work. I think in some ways doing a work like that on ourselves is the hardest, because it's the hardest to be subjectively and objectively aware. And you've done really an amazing piece of work. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
What was your experience in doing it?
Well, my experience was there's never enough. So I kept contemplating on that and trying to get to the root of it. There's never enough. And then I came across the I'm not worthy of it is where it really kind of hit the core. I'm not worthy enough. And why is it that I feel I'm not worthy enough? And then I really dug back into my childhood, and there's things that have happened that actually this money, though we relate it to money, is basically related to anything in my relationship with people and anything, you know? Uh-huh. So that's where it started getting to the real root of it, is when I started to contemplate in my past about like, you know, where it came from. It was like, sure, I remembered my teen years and my mom and that kind of upbringing. But before then, there was something more deeply rooted there where the not worthy enough came. And that's when I was just a little toddler. Yeah.
Wow, that's really fascinating. And you've done an excellent job of really discerning the beliefs that drive the behaviors and the ideas that you have that you've been operating on and just has been part of the default mode, but really looking at those core belief systems that are so powerful and influential. So that's really huge.
Yeah, it was huge for me.
I'm sorry?
I'm glad it was huge for me, and I was glad to go through the exercise. It was awesome. Yeah.
What is the major difference that doing this makes for you right now?
For me, and with all the work that I've done, it just solidifies it. Where I will catch myself with the noise between the ears. Saying, oh, I can't do it. And then I'll just say, well, why can't you do it? You know, why is it that you feel you can't do it? You know, where is this coming from? You know? So that's where, and even with this, the not worthy, I've reexamined a lot of things in my life right now, my current life with, some of the people, whether it's at work or even in my personal life, as to why I have these people in my life. Like, why am I in relationship with these people, and why do I have continual contact with these people? So what I got out of it is I really put a microscope on my present life as to who's in it and why they're in it.
Wow, that's huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very interesting. I want to take a liberty to highlight another belief system that I think you're really addressing, and you've found a way to illuminate that a bit more?
Okay, sure.
You know, I'm hearing you're talking about I can't do two careers, railroad and independent coaching, and I hear you working on not having that be an either or, that it's not mutually exclusive. If you have one paying client, then you are working, you have a coaching practice, and you have the possibility then of gradually growing that coaching practice to be able to develop it in the way that you want, so that for a while at least you may have two careers. You may be doing dual work, and you have the option within this career of developing it exactly as you want, and then at some point, if you want to make a transition where it's more totally coaching, you're able to do that. But it doesn't have to be either or, one or the other. And also, I think while you're doing that, and while you are a coach, you're also addressing another fundamental assumption that you said has been a force since early on, is trading time for money. Because when you are a professional coach and when you charge a professional fee that's based on a retainer, not on piecework, like for an hourly session, you're not in that model of trading time for money, nor are your clients. You're doing a retainer for a work, a collaboration together, that much of it involves the work that you do together, but some of it involves other things that you do, things that you'll think of, things that you'll send, the correspondence that you give. So the material that you send, there'll be other things that you do. So you're really addressing a core assumption there in the professional coaching that this is not really trading time for money. And you've heard me a number of times advocate for using a model that's not trading time for money, not setting an hourly fee, because what we do really fits into a different model in a much better way. And I think it also addresses an assumption that's an evolution for you and a transition into a professional arena instead of the hourly work, the trading time for money, as you put it. That's a great way to put it. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I totally agree. And my plan with the railway is to leave and be pensioned unless things change, and I don't anticipate them to change within 4 years. So that's a great suggestion. So I can probably swing that and just take on a client or two that I could actually fit in my schedule, which is a great idea.
Uh huh. And
it would work.
I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. No, okay.
I didn't want to talk over you. What? Say it again.
No, I said it would fit. It would fit perfectly in a transition from my 9-to-5 into a professional career, which is the coaching.
And I think it's important with every client that we'll work with, and especially for you as you presented your story in a very elegant way, that the P and the roadmap, the program new identity, is such an essential piece, because as we've talked a number of times, that our identity is the most powerful force of our human psyche. And if we make changes or behavioral changes or do something different and don't change or evolve or transform that basic model of who we are, then we'll revert back to the old behavior. And I think you really address that in talking about fourth generation railroader and the aspects of identity, the loyalty, the security, the way that you have seen yourself in that way. And that's a fundamental aspect of identity that's evolving and changing as you're looking at yourself as a professional coach. So that's a process, not an event. And if you treat it as a process, as it sounds like you are, it will be something that you can address and will have an evolution and becomes a story in and of itself as you go through that aspect of your own story change to evolve your identity to incorporate the new experiences and the new ways of seeing yourself. And it's not easy to say goodbye to something that's old and familiar, and especially four generations of it. And that's a process too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and my son says to me, "Mommy, I want to work at the railway." And I says, "No, you don't."
I want to open it up. Are there other comments or thoughts or questions? I found myself being fascinated with and dominated in the conversation, but I really want to open it up and have all of you respond. And I didn't do that a very good job of that. I didn't do a job of that at all. So. Thoughts and comments?
Then I thought it was quite powerful. The self digging you had to do to pull this together, quite impressive.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for...
Yeah, and I think that you did it in an extremely logical way, but very introspectively, that you'd really been working on this under the surface for a very long time, and it sort of gave you the structure to be methodical about putting where you've been and then a timeline for where you're going. So I think it was really well done, and it seems as if it's really helping you to, you know, move towards that target also.
Thank you.
Great.
I enjoyed it as well, and I think what I really enjoyed was just watching the progression over the years for you and mm-hmm. where you are now, but how you've evolved and really how you can take a look back. And I think that that's going to help all of us as we're doing our roadmap. And, of course, it's not an easy process to go through, but I think we're just listening to you, I think that we're really going to gain something tremendous on the other side of it. It really was. Very, very powerful. Thank you.
Thank you, Kat.
Thanks for all of your comments. Yeah, it really was an excellent launch for us to really talk about this and apply it in a way, and especially that you were bold enough not only to do it first, but to do it about yourself instead of a client. Mm-hmm. So that was very impressive. So thank you very, very much. That's very touching and very powerful.
Thank you.
Super.
Yeah, I also just wanted to add that, you know, with four generations of doing something like this, there's so much almost control involved in keeping something going, like the love for the railroad or that's your career, that making a departure at any point is something that most people just can't do and don't do. Their identity is so formed. So to be struggling with that and to really carving out a new identity for you is, you know, it takes a lot more energy and effort, I think, than many people realize. It's, you know, it's your core identity that has been formed at such a, you know, for so long that to say, oh, I want a little more than this is really being in touch with your intuition and yourself. So I really give you kudos for doing that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks.
You know, one other thing I'd like to add to that is, you know, a lot of times what you just went through, things that we tend to share only with ourselves, be able to articulate that among your peers also is a positive step forward. And it sounds like, you know, certainly the exercise you've gone through that we'll all go through will be foundation that you'll continue to build on. It won't just be something, okay, I've done this exercise and that's that. The depth of the thought pattern that you've gone through to put this together, I don't think this is going to end just with this call or with this exercise.
No, it won't. No, it certainly won't.
Well, thank you all for the very supportive and powerful comments, and I think it's an evidence of the development of a group wisdom as well as a group support, and to really take a chance and to dare to present some of your best feelings is often the greatest risk, and certainly done that in a very admirable way. So thanks very much.
Thank you, and you're very welcome.
Well, let's talk today. This is less of an application and experience near client-centered as it is just to look at some things conceptually. I want to talk about mind matters and brain business in terms of some aspects of money story specifically here. And then the subsequent seminars will talk about other stories, other aspects of life and business stories. Behavioral economics studies how people really think and behave as opposed to how they think and behave about financial matters. Neuroeconomics studies how the brain interacts with external environments to produce economic behavior. In other words, the neurobiological foundations of economic decision-making. It's now possible because we can, among other things, because we can directly observe brain functions during decision-making with people. And thirdly, emotional economics studies the interactions of mind and brain impacting money behavior and financial decisions. Now, I've listed a number, over a couple of dozens, of emotionally based financial fallacies and their remedies, beginning in the workbook section of Module 4. the compromised money behaviors and financial decisions. And this is more for our conceptualization. This is not something we're going to exactly hear from a client, but this is really how to organize and conceptualize what we're listening for and thinking about in listening to a client. So I tend to cluster things. So I see four categories of compromised money behaviors and financial decisions. It's easy for me to think of it in this way, of the ABCs, the affect or the feeling biases, the behavioral biases, the cognitive biases, and the social biases. Now, we've already discussed some in the vignettes and examples. In addition to abandoning logic and reason, most of these fallacies transcend age, gender, education, and nationality. In other words, they're ubiquitous for all of us. And I want to highlight just a couple in each of these categories, some that are most common. And I want to highlight ones that you haven't seen yet in writing on neuroeconomics or behavioral economics, but yet are nonetheless very common. First is the affective biases, the biases that are based more on feeling. Our feelings get us off track, the emotional biases. One is nostalgia bias. We feel more nostalgic at really difficult times. Nostalgia remembers things not as they were, but as we wish them to be. Airbrushed memories backlit by idealization. Nostalgia recalls the ideal rather than the real. For example, has anyone gotten worse in high school and college sports as the years go by? Or become less popular in memory replays? You know, I'm very close to being All-State in basketball twice in one season, probably by next year. And that was the season we were undefeated. So things get better over time. Marketing actually taps into these nostalgic experiences. It's easier and faster to associate a product with idealized memories than to create a new product identity. A nostalgic trigger is coupled with new information. Arnold Palmer and that old tractor, two classics preserved by one particular motor oil. Another example, invincibility bias. The seemingly inextinguishable sense of immortality that we all have when we were young, there are still whispers of that in adulthood. 19% of the population believe they're in the upper 1% of income. 90% of all drivers believe they're above average. Now, I know in Houston that's at least not true. 75% of people believe they're healthier than average. And another example, the tech rally in the late 1990s. Expertise in one area does not equate with expertise in another. From successful physician to famous artist, people may not translate their accomplishments to money or investment savvy. Different parts of the brain are involved, different talents, different mindsets. Even Warren Buffett recognized this about himself. He said, "You know, I don't think being able to allocate capital means you're really good at anything else." And another example, a final example here, from the emotional biases, optimism bias. The search for a good story can lead to miscalculating and underestimating risk. In fact, there was a study not very long ago from a neuroscience lab that shows that our brains are wired for an optimism bias. It has a good deal to do with survival. Optimism bias is a positivity illusion. It can also benefit by allowing us to engage in tasks that we wouldn't ordinarily take on. Then the sunk cost fallacy of money over time can sustain you to complete it. In other words, you're doing a deck and you allocated $1,500 and you're already at $1,800 and you're less than halfway through and you think, well, I've already put $1,800 into it. I've got to complete it now. So the sunk cost fallacy then takes over and we complete something we wouldn't have done if we'd known from the beginning. Now, here's a healthy optimism bias. When I started the company, I was 52 years old. I had diabetes, lost my gallbladder, most of my thyroid gland, but I was convinced that the best was ahead of me. That was from Ray Kroc, founder of McDonald's. Another category, the behavioral biases. And this one I'm calling the transference fallacy. In psychoanalysis, the tendency to redirect feelings from a past context to a current one is considered a type of transference. In other words, we used old software to process a new experience, a software that was tailor-made for an old context that may become outdated. An example, Digital Equipment Corporation posted a 13% decline. Hewlett-Packard collapsed half its value that same trading day after the digital equipment announcement. Digital equipment's difficulty was completely unrelated to HP's operation and profitability. The carryover? They're both computer companies. Consider how often you update the software for your computer. It's probably so often you use the automatic mode to update it. Our own software needs updating just as frequently and systematically. Now, a caveat here is don't consider adding new information to be the same as updating the operating system. Your beliefs are the software that drives behavior. We just heard a beautiful series of examples about examining beliefs and behaviors and looking in a very specific way at which ones need to be updated in the roadmap that we just heard. A subtle transference fallacy is to repeat past behaviors that actually work, but that can make a mediocre decision into a habit because conditions may change. A second example, spending justification. Just this once. It's on sale. I deserve it. It's going to cheer me up. Life is short. Now, those are mine. You've got to think of your own. I'm pretty attached to mine. Creating a just cause to spend is the creating justification. Someone takes money from retirement savings to spend. The justification? Well, it's an immediate need that's greater than an abstract future need of retirement. What's the coaching challenge here? How will you repay it? In other words, accountability. Here's a spending justification travesty. Someone adds up all the money they've saved by buying things on sale, some of which they have no use for. From that total of savings, the figure is presented as the money that we could now spend, as if it had been generated. Spending twice does not equate with saving once. And I saw just a news clip, someone from Black Friday. You know, I just got back from the store. I saved $420. Now, that's not the real story. The real story is how much money someone spent, because if they truly saved that money, they would have an account or a little stack of $420. So they didn't really save it. I mean, so that creates kind of an illusion. Here's a status quo bias, another example. The tendency to opt for what we're accustomed to, the status quo, the resistance to leaving a comfort zone. And another name for status quo is inertia. Marketers know, here's an application of this. Marketers know that when they set up a continuity program, in other words, they do what's called a force-free trial, a free three-month trial that you get to have the subscription, say, for 3 months free. You give them your credit card in the beginning in order to get that. And then beginning the fourth month, unless you unsubscribe, you're enrolled now and they begin billing you regularly. The inclination, as they know, is to stay with the familiar and not cancel. That keeps 75 to 80% of the initial free subscribers on for the long haul of paid subscription. People stick with default choices even when the choices are costly or compromised. And there was a study done that showed that 72% of people who continued the subscription did not read the material that was subscribed to. Here's an example, another example of this. Economist William Samuelson and Richard Zeckhauser found that when people are told that an investment tool has been selected for them, and they have to switch to another one if they want to opt out, an overwhelming 47% stayed with what someone else selected. which is significantly greater than what someone would have chose when four equal possibilities were presented from scratch. There was no preselection in that. In other words, people will stay with what's been presented to them or what they're enrolled for. Here's another example. Christopher Sia, University of Chicago Business School scientist, did this study with students. Asked if they would hold on to a stock that lost 50% of its value in the last 3 months, the majority were reluctant to sell and would keep the stock. He then asked the students to imagine that a cat jumps on the computer keyboard and they inadvertently sell some of the shares. Will they buy back the shares they're reluctant to sell? Hardly anyone would. The inertia effect in both instances is powerful and has little to nothing to do with the actual assessed value by each individual of the stock. The inertia effect is so powerful that in the last instance, a cat made the investment decision. Now, the power of inertia can be strategically fashioned to produce better outcomes. We can set the program, the status quo, to make good choices, the default pattern. An example is an automatic enrollment savings program for retirement, or, and the real secret is, you don't have to be employed by someone to do that. You can set up an automatic transfer of X amount of money from your checking account to your retirement account the first of every month and make one decision that can make a big difference for the rest of your life. Another category, the third category, cognitive biases. And here's a diagnosis bias. Once we label a person or situation, we're prone then to seek data to confirm that notion more vigorously and couple that with blindness to evidence that contradicts it. A couple of economists, Barry Stahl and Ha Wang, have studied skill categories and stats of new NBA players since 1984. They distill these stats into three skill measuring categories: scoring, quickness, and toughness. They looked at all the variables that determine playing time in games, from skill categories to player's performance to injury or trade status. There was one variable, though, that had greater impact than any of these actual performance data, and that was the player's draft selection order. Diagnosis bias. In fact, draft order was the variable that was more highly correlated with playing time through the first 5 years in the NBA, which was as long as they studied these stats. Even though skill and performance determines a draft order, once picked, coaches and managers should only be interested in the player's performance. In other words, once the draft is over, the draft number's history and performance is everything. Then, for the next 5 years, how the managers and coaches expected them to perform was still more significant than how they actually did perform. Confirmation bias. Another example, extrapolation errors, predicting the future based on the past. Peter Bernstein, who Money Magazine called the smartest living investor, said, extrapolation errors are the most common mistake made in investing. Nassim Nicholas Taleb described the black swan effect in the book by that name as a highly improbable event characterized by unpredictability, a huge impact, and an explanation retrospectively concocted that makes it make sense and seem even more predictable than it really is. Examples: the success of Google, the Internet, the occurrence of 9/11. Before we knew about the Internet, we could never have predicted that it would exist or how huge the impact would be. The same with black swans. Before Australia was discovered, people thought all swans were white. How this occurs is notable. Our brains are hardwired to focus on specifics rather than principles. Additionally, we concentrate on what we already know and give little consideration to what we don't know. Then, once we see something, we retrospectively say, well, yeah, I kind of expected that. I kind of knew that all along. Well, of course they're black swans because, you know, the swans are going to be other than white. We should have seen 9/11 coming. A coin is flipped and lands on tails 6 times in a row. What's your guess what the next flip will be? This is often the gambler's fallacy. It's easy now that we have a cool head and we're not in the flow of it, not, don't have any money riding on it. No matter how many times in a row tails comes up, it's no more likely to come up tails than heads the next flip. It's still 50-50 the next time. The fallacy exists because we remember and we attribute meaning. We see patterns and infer narratives where none exist. We make stories. Our mind needs a story, and our brains seek closure. Never mind that the closure is not accurate, not a cause and effect, but simply a closure. Our minds and our psyches both abhor ineffectiveness. Doing nothing is often the hardest. In fact, and money managers are very aware of this, faced with the reality of losing money in a declining market, the instinct is to do something to avert or reverse the loss. We have a bias, including a cultural bias, against inactivity, as well as our brains predicting the future on the basis of the past. Anytime two things recur in a row, the brain predicts a third. And the fourth category, ABCs, the S, social biases. One is an affinity bias. We underestimate the risk of things that we like, that we favor. We overestimate the risk of things we don't like foreign enemies or an out-of-favor investment. You bet $20 on a favorite in the Super Bowl and you lose, that's unlucky. You bet $200 on your alma mater to win their college game, even though they have the worst record in the conference. That's affinity bias. We bet on something that has no reason necessarily other than we like it. We have an emotional affinity for it. Most of these mistakes focus on the past or the future. And that's important as we're listening to clients, to really listen for how they're thinking about something. How do they go about thinking about something to conclude what they do? And to listen if that makes sense. And if it doesn't, if we can get curious together with them. Examples of mistakes using past data, a past label to identify, or old software to process, transference bias. An example of a mistake looking to the future, optimism bias, extrapolation error. An example of an extrapolation error that resulted in a slight underestimate of prediction going forward was this one made in 1943. I think there's a world market for maybe 5 computers. That was a prediction made by Thomas Watson, then chairman of IBM. Now, let's talk, and feel free to interrupt me at any point if there are questions or comments or you want to talk about something in greater length or if you want to add something. I welcome that very much. Anyone want to jump in?
I said something a minute ago that the brain focuses on something rather on something.
Whenever there are two things in a row, the brain predicts a third. You know, it's the basis of a lot of jokes, set up, payoff. J. Paul Getty said that there are three things that you need to do in order to get immense wealth. Wake up early. Work hard, find oil. See, whenever stocks go up 2 quarters in a row, the brain predicts a third repetition. So that's something we have to be aware of, is that we are inclined to predict a third thing whenever there are two things in a row. So sometimes we have to outsmart our brain in that, because what we would naturally inclined to predict on a default mode may not be the accurate thing, but it's what makes sense to our brain. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. I'll touch on that a little bit more in a later. That's such an important principle, because that has to do with really looking at accurate prediction and sorting out things. Let's talk about, and this is going to apply a little bit, with money and value. And these are some assorted things to think about. We grow up with the idea that we have to go to work to make to earn money. If you view your work as where you get your satisfaction rather than your money, you can reframe the experience. Plus, you can set up different ways of serving people. Figure out how to bring value to people, how to provide them your service or product, and you'll be rewarded. But you have to create a strategic pathway to be rewarded. If you don't have a purpose for each dollar that you have or will have, you may not have it. Remember how having a goal enhances motivation, and having a deadline crystallizes focus to complete the requirements of the deadline. I was talking with my What's Next exec partner, and he was talking about looking at 2014 and setting certain things on his calendar, something that he would, a presentation he would do, a retreat he would do, to set a date for something, and that would crystallize his activity to get ready for it. He wouldn't wait until he was totally ready and then set the date. He'd set the date and back into it. So there is a value of doing things in that way. If you let's examine that a little bit more. I want to be sure that makes sense. Maybe if you didn't have the deadline, the work would have dragged out. Economics and wealth work in the same way. If you don't have a clear, crystallized vision of how you'll earn, manage, and ultimately use each dollar, the dollar may not manifest. If you place wealth as a goal, yet have a contradictory belief, a shadow story, that the pursuit of wealth is materialistic, you have a conflict, a surface and a shadow story that oppose each other and don't go in the same direction. A conflict simply means you're writing two stories simultaneously that at least in some way contradict one another. Wealth will not accrue contrary to a value, an ideal, that opposes it, or to ambivalence about it. Ambivalence saps power. If saving is not your goal, you won't accidentally save money. Review your list of ideals. If your goals and ideals don't match, or if the ones that do are not high on the list, other items are going to subjugate wealth accumulation or whatever you value. And that's one of the reasons that I ask most clients to do needs and ideals is I want to be sure that everything we talk about in terms of goals and strategies fit with needs and ideals, that all of somebody's going to be going in the same direction. Each person decides how to define money. Each person can make his or her own decision and definition, or let others hijack the agenda and determine the meaning. The key to making money is creating value and doing it consistently. People pay when you add value to their lives. They reward you with what they feel the value is when you ask. Now, I want to go into an area, Angel Spirit of Tread, spirituality and money. One of my favorite descriptions of spirituality is from John Updike. Pressed, I would define spirituality as the shadow of light humanity casts as it moves through the darkness of everything that can be explained. Now, there does not have to be a split between spirituality and money. Spirituality and profitability can be very compatible. There's nothing intrinsically unspiritual about money. It's one of those assumptions like starving artists. Why should someone of exceptional talent have difficulty converting that ability into significant income? They may just need a coach. Abundance, wealth, spirituality are synonyms. The antonyms, suffering, scarcity, non-spiritual. You may not really know what it's truly like to be spiritual unless you're wealthy. How free to be spiritually resonant can you be if you're worried about making the rent payment by the first of the month? Remember, wealthy does not automatically equate with worldly riches, but it must incorporate aspects of freedom and choice that is in the context of the experience of abundance. If you spend some of your energy preoccupied with scarcity, with barely making it on your income each month, you may not have carved out the space to experience true spirituality. if you are running and a bear is chasing you, you don't have the freedom of a contemplative moment to think great thoughts or create new ideas. Same with money and spirituality. When someone says, I'm not in it for the money, I believe that person because I know the experience, unless it's a rationalization for not making much money. When you're truly immersed, passionate, and delivering immense value, this is synonymous with abundant income. It's the result when there is alignment. Having a fantastic experience of bringing value to people and making fantastic money are seamlessly interwoven in a spiritual path. If you're not making enough money, the question is, why are you not showing up? Where or what part of you is hiding out? Rich and spiritual are synonyms. And remember, rich is not equal worldly wealth as a necessity. You will improve your health by creating less stress, as stress causes the body to be less healthy. You will create an attitude and an experience of abundance, which also enhances wellness. Now, I want to talk for a moment about value and beliefs. Money is a token of value, but it can't replace value. The value we attribute, the belief, can fundamentally change how we perceive something. You already know how beliefs can determine how much you really enjoy your Cabernet Sauvignon, or that test, that study. Let's look briefly now at the background music for this wine tasting. On a January morning in 2007, during rush hour, an ordinary-looking guy dressed in jeans and a baseball cap took out his violin in a subway station in Washington, D.C. For the next 43 minutes, he performed one of the most challenging pieces composed for the violin, Bach's sonatas and partitas for unaccompanied violin. 1,097 people walked by. I saw the video of this study. He was barely noticed. Just playing on a passenger platform like an average street performer. Actually, one person out of 1,097 stopped, lingered, and recognized who he was. His name, Joshua Bell, one of the greatest violinists alive, who regularly performs to sold-out crowds at concert halls throughout the world. His violin, a $3.5 billion Stradivarius. In this study by the Washington Post, the D.C. commuters heard a world-class concert, but the value they attributed to Bell's performance was based on their perception. And he wasn't even mugged for his violin. Value attribution, as one of the social biases in the ABC's list, is our own shortcut to determine how we judge what we see, even if it's worthy of our attention or not. Then the value we assign shapes our perception. Look carefully at your beliefs, the assumptions of your money story. We heard a beautiful accounting of that with the roadmap earlier. These beliefs, the assumptions, are ghostwriting your vision. The most common reason people don't accumulate wealth is they don't really believe they can. Or if they do, they don't devise a specific plan and stick to it. Tell me your assumptions, and I can tell you how much money you'll make. Beliefs are the software that drives behavior. We now know that beliefs can actually turn genes on or turn them off. Beliefs. In changing your belief and the result of the change in your action, you're also changing your mind as well as your brain. Mental models and context determination. Something I want to talk just a little bit about because I think it's important for us in coaching and how we're listening. A mental model is a representation of external reality inside our heads. A mental model incorporates knowledge and principles about the world. We each have several mental models in our head. Mental models are simply stories. The stories are composed of our own metaphors, which explain by us, to us, both the tangible and the intangible. If we don't have enough mental models, we tend to overuse the ones we have. To a man with a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. We overreach and apply the same mental model to solve more problems than it actually can. And I saw this frequently in psychiatry and psychoanalysis. People would have a favorite model, and they would fit the situation or the data into that model. even though it left out stuff or it wasn't an exact fit, it didn't work at times. The models that we choose then need to come from different disciplines, I believe. One discipline can't possibly encompass all the wisdom of the world. An example of a mindset in action is how we make decisions to purchase products. Neuroscience laboratories have shown that if we're attracted by a product, it's because we identify with it. It's because the product fits the picture we have of ourselves or who we want to become, as shown by increased brain activity in scanning experiments. Mental models are stored in the hippocampus, the brain's memory focal point. A recent discovery reported in Science magazine was of a new cell type called border cells. Border cells are active to really discern the limits of an ending and another beginning. And what this means, really, is that the brain functions like a Google map. It creates multiple independent maps while finding its way in the world. In other words, when a new situation arises, our brain boots up another map. This is not an analog function here. When one context or environment ends and another begins, another map's booted up. This explains how we have different context or frames for different situations. This is the essence of having different states of mind or mindsets. These maps are stored in the unconscious. These are our mental models. So these mental models, including beliefs and behaviors, were downloaded beginning in the first years of life. This is how, for example, money scripts began to be written by caregivers early in life. These scripts are often so deeply ingrained that they're not even conscious. And this was some of the really impressive work that we heard from Lynn in really looking at and examining this, have the insight and the introspection to examine these and to crystallize the issues here. Yet, you can rewrite these programs in your mind, first by recognizing exactly what you're doing, and you're writing your own story. So, let's extend this to money and mood now. A mindset can determine money behavior. Particular associations are connected with certain economic decisions. Dr. Jennifer Lerner's lab at Harvard studies emotions and decision-making. I think we can learn a lot from her. Specifically, she investigates how social and emotional factors influence judgment and decision-making. Here are just some simple examples. People feeling depressed are willing to spend more money than when they're in a better mood. One example of how social events affect money behavior is the day that Lehman Brothers failed, the expensive shops of New York's Madison Avenue had one of their best days in history. People try to counter feeling down by shopping, because shopping is mood changing. The anticipation of spending money boots up dopamine, the pleasure hormone. So when the going gets tough, the tough can go shopping. Another example, people who are angry will take on more financial risk. They tend to get more aggressive. Your pain seeks out money, thinking money and spending will make it go away. Your pleasure seeks out money, thinking money will enhance and extend the pleasure. Money issues can work as a navigation system to find old beliefs and behaviors that currently don't work. Uncertainty or anxiety can rigidify principles into rules. Neuroeconomists have demonstrated that people who are fearful cling to what they have. They hunker in. Our nervous system is why people don't spend very much when there's a downturn or when there's a setback. Our nervous system shuts down in an adaptive effort at survival. The result is a restriction in the ability of our minds and bodies to function. At a time of crisis, fear, or uncertainty, people reduce spending. When fear is dominant, money is not only constricted, but hoarded. Consumers are risk-averse and hunker down. This has been called the negative wealth effect. Some additional considerations of money and mood relationships. When you feel bad or down, your attention scatters because of low dopamine. Dopamine, remember, is the brain chemical stimulation and excitement. Serves as a gateway to the regulation of working memory. To remedy, we often find things to spike our mood. Food, stimulation, risk, a new relationship. When you feel excited, which is a spike in dopamine, your attention is alert to new opportunity. If a task becomes too easy or too routine, dopamine wanes, and the low stimulation means that you're going to soon be distracted. When a task is hard, you may give up. If it's just hard enough, though, and you have a belief that you can be effective, even with enough of an optimism bias, you'll sustain attention and effort to create a steady flow of dopamine. This sustained state of mind is an important component to long-term achievement. So this is what we want to think about in terms of laddering strategies for success and laddering goals with clients, to not have it all or nothing, but to have it laddered. Another way of thinking about this relationship of mood money is that with sadness, spending attempts mood repair, and buying boosts the sense of self-worth. Researchers led by Cynthia Kreider found that sad people become self-focused and spend as much as 300% more for the same type of commodity, the same item, as when they're not sad. The new purchases distract from what's bothering someone. A new possession reduces both anxiety and sad mood because the act of spending stimulates the pleasure center in the same way that cocaine does, dopamine. Since spending is an attempted self-regulation of a mood, some of these principles may apply. Make no purchases when sad or upset. Spend only cash when sad or upset. And have a fixed amount or a limited amount. Use other means of self-regulation than money. Connection with friends, listening to music, other distractions like reading or exercise. There is a blog, I think it's still in the archives, I forgot how many, 15 ways to outsmart your brain to spend less. I've forgotten the exact number, but it's a compilation of a number of things like this. Neuroscience has demonstrated that humans have two decision systems, an analytical and an intuitive one. And this is really what Kahneman has written about with his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, the intuitive system, the analytical one. Different situations and patterns activate different parts of the brain. Andrew Lowe, MIT finance professor, found these relationships. Financial success triggers the same neural circuits that cocaine does, the dopamine system. With increasing financial success, investors become increasingly immune to risk, taking greater chances and hoping to have greater success. Risk is both stimulating and addictive. It creates a dopamine and adrenaline rush of excitement. What this also means, for example, is a strategy planned while you're calm at your office or home may miss the mark about how you'll respond in a different state of mind, such as stress. Now, something I want to mention, too, before we stop or have a discussion is priming. Our decisions are very reliant on the context of our experience. Priming is what psychologists define as the incidental activation of knowledge structure by a current situational context. In other words, booting up a particular mindset. A practical effect of priming is that what we perceive influences how we make decisions, even if it's illogical or irrelevant. An example here, a test was done in which French and German wines were offered in a supermarket. The wines were matched for price and quality. After the choice was made, a researcher approached the customer and asked why he picked the particular wine he did. The customer typically mentioned things like price, quality, anticipation of the match of the meal, or knowledge of the vendor. The researcher then asked whether the customer noticed what kind of music was being played and if it had any bearing on his decision. many customers acknowledged hearing the music, but almost all indicated it had nothing to do with their decision. When French music was played, French wines were selected 77% of the time. When German music was played, German wines were selected 73% of the time. 86% of the people, even after they were told about this inclination and this research, said the tunes had no influence on their choices. They denied it had any possibility. So, with irrelevant information, we assume that people become well-informed about the options they're considering to make decisions. But on close scrutiny, this notion is contrary to how our minds work. People do not even respond in reasonable ways to information available to them. An example of this is a proposition offered by Robert Franks, an economics professor at Cornell. People who set their watches a few minutes ahead do so sensibly to ensure punctuality. But when they're asked for the time, they perform the necessary subtraction before they answer. So they're not fooled by the incorrect information of the watch. They just work harder to perceive the image at face value, to do the subtraction, and then to reframe the actual time for their schedule. So it doesn't really work. So, in summary then, I want to just summarize some bullet points. Considerations to factor mind and brain influence. Know exactly what you need and want. Focus your decisions on your end point and know what good enough is. If you're not clear and precise, you may become susceptible to charm, persuasion, brand, advertising, and social pressure. Make certain what is offered, a product or a service or a process, makes sense and feels right to you. Look at the benefits directly to you. Look at the benefits to the seller. Recognize the mind's inclination to justify and rationalize a decision and to deny worst-case scenarios. Remember that the brain is hardwired for optimism. A common optimism, also called present denial, is to believe that your income will rise to pay off debt or keep up with an oversized mortgage. We judge our decisions by what we see others doing. If a neighbor buys a new car, we are inclined to rationalize a purchase. Mirror neurons are at play here in the brain. Oxytocin release occurs with the experience of connection with others. Goods at an auction, and we have a resident expert here on garage sales that can easily parlay into auction mentality. Bids at an auction start low so that people get more involved and bidders get emotionally attached to an item. That's why some savvy people start an item at $1 on internet bidding. Set an endpoint for any item that you consider purchasing to minimize emotional shaping of economic decision. And finally, recent research has shown that we're more likely to trust people who look like us. Researchers even demonstrated that we are likely to entrust money to strangers whose faces on a computer screen were digitally manipulated to resemble the volunteers. A University of Aberdeen study found that trust increased almost 50% when faces were changed to look like the volunteer. And this is something from the neuroscience of sales that we establish a common factor, a bridge between us and the person who we want to influence for sale. Now, I didn't save as much time as I'd hoped. Your thoughts and questions about this material. I know a lot of it is not experience near and directly related to working with clients, but It's ways that I think that understanding how our mind and brain work, especially in the area of money, can be a model for other ways of other decision-making in all aspects of life and in writing various stories. Any thoughts or questions?
Um, I was just kind of curious about some of this seems, maybe from your background also, that not just relating to money, but perhaps even with relationships, people get very, they start discounting maybe a relationship if, in fact, it is similar to one they've experienced before without, you know, in other words, just fully understanding it. It seems as if this kind of information can be applied so many different, you know, ways in life that it's a little amazing to me.
Absolutely. And that kind of transference, to transfer from an older model to a current situation, is something we have to always be aware of, because it can be limiting. And this is something, there's a whole area of very well-known and well-developed research in infant research and now applied to adult attachment that is one of the chapters I worked on last month, because nothing about this has been applied to coaching yet. But our attachment patterns, the kind of behavior patterns that we have vis-a-vis other people, the typical ways that we relate to people, much of which is not exactly conscious, but we'll tend to relate in similar ways and recreate attachment patterns and behavior patterns with other people without even being aware of it. And this can really be dynamite for successful people, but for some people who repeat patterns that are limiting or have a glass ceiling or in fact create derailments in a relationship, these are things that we can also work on in coaching, because this is a here and now manifestation. And I think when we have the recognition, just as you mentioned, about the kinds of attachment patterns and which ones work for what and when it isn't working, can be immensely useful in coaching. So this is this is something. In fact, it's going to be a future white paper for the quarterly mentor group. So I'm not ready to, you know, to release it for public consumption yet, because I still have a lot of work on it. But there's information from a number of disciplines that I think can be important there. So, in other words, that's a long-winded version of, I think you're very right. And I think it can be immensely useful to look at and think of it in that way, and to apply it in ways of various aspects of ways that we create our stories, because so much of our operating systems have been downloaded early on, or at least have been shaped and formed by many influences. If 90 to 95% of our operating systems are not conscious, that's exactly the value that we bring in coaching, is to help someone be aware and to help them look at and understand their story. And that's really what the roadmap is about, to deconstruct someone's story and to help them reconstruct a new or better or more evolved one. So,
And just regarding attachment, I've always found it really interesting and actually very relevant, because the patterns that we talked about very often that we're trying to overcome, or some people are trying to overcome, have been hardwired, usually by a parent. I mean, so I just wondered if you had any other research or any other books or whatever regarding this that would be worthwhile taking a look at.
So much of the research is from infant research about, and that was begun in the 50s. But there's been work recently. In fact, one of the books I looked at to get some update from, is a book called Attached, just ATTACHED. The subtitle is The New Science of Adult Attachment. And the two authors are Levine, L-E-V-I-N-E, and Heller, H-E-L-L-E-R. I don't remember their first names. But that's a very savvy book that looks, it's mostly looking at it in terms of love relationships, but I think you can read beyond that to look at applications in other kinds of relationships and just connections with people.
So it's Attached, The New Science?
Attached. The title is Attached, ATTACHED. The subtitle is The New Science of Adult Attachment.
Adult Attachment. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You bet. Well, thank you all very much. Look forward to picking up with you next week. Have a great rest of the week, guys. See you now. Thanks for all your input and interchange.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.